always nice to be behind one of these and not have to turn a plea. Not guilty. I never once woke up on a jail floor and thought they got the wrong guy. I was knowing I did something. Anyway, my name is Jerry Wills. I am a recovered alcoholic. Hey, this is amazing. My sponsor always says, it's no big thing, Jerry. I'm like, I wish you could be here right now and say this is no big thing, because this is a big thing. And just so you know, I'm terrified. Anytime I ever speak, I'm terrified. I'm kind of like a duck on the pond. On the surface, everything looks good, but underneath, my feet are kicking to stay afloat, right? And I always, you know, think that you're judging me, and I know that. And it's like, you know what, why don't you give everybody a pen and paper and they can take my inventory while I'm up here, and then afterwards I'll find somebody and go do a fifth step, right? Thank the committee. Dave made this very possible for me. I was supposed to be here a couple of years ago, we couldn't, and Margo, and, you know, Terry and Carla and Mark blew me away. If I can carry a portion of the message that you carried, I'll be satisfied with what I'm done here. You know, and my life is second to none in Alcoholics Anonymous. Like, I shouldn't be here. Guys like me don't end up in conferences in Mexico. Guys like me, where I came from in the alley, that's where I thought I belonged. And, you know, I had some friends come down here with me, and we met a bunch of other people. And, you know, it's just been so welcoming, and it's truly, you're smiling. Is that better?
Yeah.
All right, sorry. Yeah, so, you know, I got to walk around downtown Puerto Vallarta yesterday, and, you know, we went in this cathedral, and it blew me away. I've seen pictures of that before, and I thought, oh, my God, that's beautiful. But the difference is I had knowledge about that, and after that, I had an experience with it, and I went in there, and I touched the walls, and you can smell the smells, and, you know, it's just an amazing feeling. I sat down, and I just started to well up on the inside, realizing, you know what, like, I'm not lucky, I'm blessed. You know, and I'm not here because I've done the steps, or I take people through the steps, or because I have a home group, or, you know, all that type of stuff. I'm sober by God's grace, and I get to do those things. See, I don't magically do things to keep myself sober, right? And that's where, and if you don't know what God's grace is, it's the undeserved, unwarranted gift, right? And if I got what I deserved, I'd be chopped up or locked up, right? Because I'm a low-life bag. And, you know, I know you may not be able to tell this right now, but I was a rowdy drinker, and I know it's a far-fetched to see what you have here. I would start mosh pits in people's living room and stuff, and, you know, and it was amazing. And, you know, when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, June 2nd, 2008 is my sober date. That's the day I took my last drink. And so I'm about 14 and a half years sober, and I'm nervous every time I do this. And, you know what, like, the due diligence, always the committee, you know, amazing job, the volunteers. So I like to look at the background scene, because it's easy for me to come here, you know, sit, speak for an hour, and then go back home and, you know, not pay acknowledge to all the people that put hard, hard work into this. And, you know, so I like to thank the committee and the volunteers as well. If you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, I want to welcome you. If you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, we got good news and bad news here. The good news, you have a new family. Bad news, we're it. You know, and as a newcomer, you also need to realize something. We clap for everything here. Your wife kicked you out of the house, yay. Got another DUI, yay. Mark screwed up on the traditions, yay. I find that very hilarious that we do that, you know. And, you know, the journey through Alcoholics Anonymous for me, I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on my drinking. What I want to talk about is what happened after I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know what, on that June 2nd, 2008, I was in an alley in the downtown east side of Vancouver. And I don't know if anybody knows that, but it's probably the biggest open trade drug market in the entire world. And I had to give up my house and my daughter in Victoria, British Columbia, to try to get away from myself. And of course, you all know we bring us with us. And you know what, I wasn't an alcoholic from the first time I drank. I know a lot of people are. They're like freeze-dried alcoholics just waiting for Jack Daniels, right? And I was one of those guys that went the other way. I had my first drink when I was 11, and I kind of liked the feeling, and I did a little bit more after that. And you know what? At that time, you know, somebody, I ask everybody this because it talks about the martyr. What am I talking about? The first drink. The teetotaler, the heavy drinker, and the alcoholic. And I always ask people, how many drinks does a teetotaler have? And everybody goes, three. I said, well, one that you don't count, right? As an alcoholic, I know what I've done. I drank a 2-4, 26, or, you know, half a 8-ball of cocaine, and, you know, I have that all down. And you know what? I'm not going to lie. I love alcoholic probably still more than most people who drink, right? And I love the flavor of alcohol, Jack Daniels and Lucky Beer, right? I also love Pepsi, but I've never sat down, drank a 2-4 and a 2-liter in one session before. Because it didn't have that desired effect, you know, that ease and comfort that eventually came. And, you know, it was probably around 13 years old, thinking I'm a big shot, had a keg party at my house, and this girl's kicking my ass at quarters. And I'm guzzling beers and beers, and it finally got to the point where I could not put another drop of anything into my body. And so what I went and did, and you guys might relate to this, I went outside and I put two fingers down my throat and I puked, and I came back, call it a puking rally, you know? And I don't realize that other people don't drink like that, because to me, they look the same. And you know what, I don't understand that. And you know, long before I became alcoholic, as an identified alcoholic, I'd done a lot of shitty things around life. And you know what, like, I've hurt a lot of people. And some people I meant to. Most of them, no. And that was my family, who I cared more than anything in the entire world. And you know what, I've been blessed with three kids. And when my first daughter was born, Shantaya, when she was delivered, they gave her to me. I took off my shirt and we linked heartbeats together. And I promised that child at that time that I will always be there. I will always support you. I'll always care for you. You'll never have to worry about anything in your life. And I meant that with every fiber in my being. And alcohol took that away from me. You know, I was 6.5 years sober before I made amends to those kids. And so Alcoholics Anonymous gave me that relationship back 10 times the best I could ever imagine. I have relationships with my two ex-wives better than the best they were when we were happily married, you know? And you know, my first wife, I always tell her she was smart and beautiful. I married a smart and beautiful woman, and she married a figment of my imagination, right? And you know, it was, and I remember when we first started to date, she invited me to her house to pick her up for a date, and she said, I'm not done getting ready, get yourself something to drink in the fridge. And I opened the fridge, and there's orange juice and milk and water, and there's a bottle of champagne on the door. And I yelled up and I said, do you know I have a bottle of champagne in your fridge? She goes, yeah, I'm saving it till New Year's. This is in October. I'm like, you could die before then, right? And she would say things to me like, you drank that whole six pack? I'm like, well, that's how they sell them. Like, isn't that the least amount? Or she'd be at a party, she's like, we gotta get out of here. And I say, why? She goes, I'm too drunk. My thought is, if you can say it, it ain't true. You know? And, you know, at this point in my life, I don't realize that I'm drinking out of necessity and not because I want to. You know, and it comes to the point in my life where alcohol is as important to air to me as. And you know what, like, so as I come into Alcoholics Anonymous, I got sober June 2nd, 2008 in an alley called Blood Alley in the downtown East Side. And I'd been on a run of about 110 days in a row of minimum, you know, 15 pack of beer, Mickey. And then towards the end of that, though, when that run was coming, I had no more money. And I was drinking sherry from the back of a Chinese restaurant, $3 a bottle. And eventually I couldn't afford that either. And I go to the hospitals and steal hand sanitizer. And I can tell you, there's no mix, there's no chaser that will get rid of the flavor of hand sanitizer. But at that point, I have to, and I don't know that. Because I come into Alcoholics Anonymous not knowing, and you know, my journey began that morning. I remember I was out in a back alley drinking beer, and I had this moment of clarity. I seen this guy, he was all freaking out and twitching out around this garbage can. I'm like, holy shit, if I'm not careful, I end up like that guy. And I was like, wait a minute, you're in the same alley. You know, and I had that moment of clarity, and I walked out of that alley, and I started walking down Cordova Street. At this time, you gotta understand, I've been homeless for 19 months. Living in shelters, and I had a full-time job 6 days a week, 12 hours a day, and I'd have $1,500 in my pocket, and I'd be eating at a soup kitchen. And if anybody's ever been homeless on the downtown east side, or you understand the downtown east side, when you see a line, you just go stand in it, right? You don't even know what it's for. It's food or clothes or something free, and that's for sure. And you know, and it was a hot summer days, and I was walking down Cordova, and I seen this lineup, and I'd seen the lineup there a few times. And one of the support staff there looked at me and said, hey man, are you hungry? And my thought was, I haven't eaten in days. I can't remember the last time. I said, yeah. He says, well, come on in. And they bring me into a chapel. I'm like, oh, you duped me, right? First you're gonna preach to me, right? And then you're gonna feed me. And you know, they went through a little talk there, and they said they had a shelter at this place, a hostel for men. And I've been staying at another one called Catholic Charities. We used to call ourselves crackheads with curfews because you had to be in by 11. And my thought was, you know what, maybe if I stay here tonight, I can straighten up a little bit. I can get my, you know, get back to what I wanted to do. And that night of that devotion, they said that. And I woke up the next morning and I said, what's this thing about a treatment center? And this guy turned around and ran like Forrest Gump away. I'm like, oh, well, he's a real help here, right? And about 2 minutes, he shows up with an application. I'm like, I don't need that. I got clothes. I got money in my pocket. He goes, well, just read it over. And, you know, they kick you out of there about 7 a.m. in the morning, and they go across the street, place called The Open Door, and they feed you, you know, donuts and coffee, and they sing some hymns and do some prayers and stuff. And I reached into my bag, and I pulled out this application form. I don't know if this happened to anybody else, but the words started to jump around on the page. And I said, screw this, and I crumpled it up, and I threw it in my backpack. And about, you know, an hour into that, one of the guys that worked there, his name's Mike J. He's my angel to this day. And he came up to me and he says, I've never seen you here before. I said, yeah, it's my first time. And he said, can you do us a favor? I said, what's that? He said, afterwards, can you stay behind and help us clean up? And I said, yeah, man, no problem. And, you know, floats by, everybody's filing out. I went up to his office, said, where's the broom? And he said, let's not see that broom. Let's see that little piece of paper you had. I'm like, duped again. Right? And within about 15 minutes, I'm talking to a counselor at this treatment center. And he's asking me impossible questions to answer. Number one is like, how are you? I don't know. And then the other one he asked, he said, do you ever drink alone? And I said, when I'm buying yes, when you're buying no, you know? And I'm greedy when it comes to drinking. I had a guy tell me one time we're drinking together, he goes, I'm saving this for Ron. I said, who's Ron? He goes, later on when you're not around, right? Because I drink all mine really fast, and I'm grinding you on yours, and, you know, but I don't understand at this point what the physical part of Alcoholics Anonymous is, because I've never been to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and they said I had to have 72 hours to get into this treatment center, and they said, can you do that? And I said, yeah. And in hindsight, it had been over 15 years since I put 3 days back to bed again. It's not like every single day I got trashed, but there was a day I'd smoke a joint, you know, have a beer or whatnot, but a lot of the times they were, and, you know, it's funny because in this treatment center, I got in on the 6 day sober, but I detoxed on that chapel floor on a 3-inch floor for 3 days. And I had convulsions. I was seeing shadows. Spiders were crawling on my body, and I went to bad DTs. And, you know, the ambulance came. I said, if you take me, I'm going to run. Just let me ride this out. And, you know, when I got into this treatment center, and some of the people in here know my background. When I was young, I used to play in satanic bands. And I ended up in a Christian treatment center. So God had a great sense of humor right from the start, you know. And, you know what, I remember it was, I was 6 days sober. I went to my first meeting. So Alcoholics Anonymous did not get me sober. Alcoholics Anonymous has kept me sober, but I got sober. And what I understood only through years of meditation, that my first experience was in that alley. When I walked out of that alley, I was stone cold sober, as though I'd never had a drink before. And you know what, we got into there and they took me to my very first meeting, 6 days sober at the, I'll mention, best meeting in Vancouver if you're ever there, Wednesday night can light at the Atlanta Club, that's my home group. It's been my home group for about 14 and a half years. We are a primary purpose meeting. We go there and we carry the message of love, power, and freedom from the bondage of self to the alcoholic who still suffers, you know, and that's the deal. And you know what, like, I go to meetings, and I go for two reasons, essentially. Number one, because I need to hear the message. But number two, if the opportunity is given, to try carry a message. Right, and that's all anybody would try to do this weekend here. And you know what, I have my own bumbling way I do it. Some people like it, some people don't. If you don't, I hope you got a sponsor you can go bitch to. You know, and so I'm gonna focus on getting sober, right? Because that's what I didn't know that's what I wanted when I got here. I know I wanted the consequences to go away. I know I wanted my wife and my kids and my business back. And just so you know, none of that happened. The kids came back, but all the other stuff never came back. And today I'm okay with that. You know, and so I'm in this treatment center, and it was a 12-step-based treatment center. And I remember going to meetings, and I couldn't understand anything. You're talking about the phenomenon of craving and, you know, make your amends, and I don't understand any of the big book, you know, lingo. And finally, it was like one day, I just, you know, they're all talking about doing steps. And I said, fine, I'll do your stupid stairs, right? I'll get an upper power, right? And I came into Alcoholics Anonymous in wet diapers. I was booing and whaying the whole way. And you know what I realized, though, is when I walked into that very first meeting, when I crossed over a threshold into that room, that I entered a brand new world, and I did not know my life could be that good. And you know what? The things that I'm sure of today, the two most things that I'm sure of today, is there is a God and I'm not him. And the second one was God will always love me more than I could possibly ever love him. you know, I don't know, I'm going to make payments to a higher power that I'll never be able to fully pay. But what I'll do is I'll help my brothers and sisters in this fellowship to help them get sobriety. And you know what? It's not my job to say when you get sober. My job is to provide the opportunity when you're ready to get sober. You know, and some people say, God never gives me more than I can handle. I'm like, God always gives me more than I can handle. See, that way I can rely on him, right? If he only gave enough for me to handle, I would have no need for God, and neither would you. You just come see Jerry the answer guy, solve all your problems for you, right? But it doesn't work like that. It doesn't work like that. And I did not know that when I came in. You know, and I remember I was in that treatment center, and there was a blog on an AA site said, members who attended church on a regular basis improved their chances of staying sober by 10%. And at that time, I was told the recovery rate was around 10%. And so just before that, though, I remember the very first time I was walking into a church meeting, I'm like, I'm not going in there. Right? Like, I'm going to burst into flames as soon as I walk through that door. And you know what? Today, I spend more time in churches than most religious people do. And yeah, so 12-step based program. And it was funny because the steps were half AA and half NA. I don't know if you've ever seen them, all the questions, like 500 questions on it. And so for the first month I was here, I called myself Bisteptual. And you know, but at this point, I don't understand the God thing. And so I ended up going to a church that next day after I read that blog. And you know, and I went there and I went in the back pews and I fell asleep. You know, they said, go to church. They didn't have to pay any attention. And you know, eventually I'm doing Bible studies and they're doing morning devotions. And you know, and next thing you know, I'm listening to the sermon. You know, I'm a musician. I like the music and that type of stuff. And I was about probably 40 days sober, maybe 35 days sober. And the pastor said, somebody in right here wants to give their life to Jesus. And before I even knew it, I was walking up the front of the aisle. And I went up to the front and they anointed me and through all, and they said a prayer. And without a word of a lie, the sun came through the stained glass window and every hair on my body stood up, and I'm an instant spiritual giant. Like, you can't get any more, you know, spirituality than me. Me and God are so close, he owes me $10 from a game of crib last night. That's how close we are. And I also forgot to mention, there's three ways to do the talks. And I don't know, when I first came in, I did what all the guys in the treatment center I was doing. We complained about our counselors and our ex-wives and, you know, our jobs and stuff. And that's all I knew how to do until I met someone who says, no, the meeting that we're here for 1 hour in a meeting, we're going to talk about the solution to alcoholism, right? Before the meeting, if you want to talk about your wife one more time, I'll listen. I show up at my home group at about 10 to 7, the meeting's at 8, and after that, about 20 of us go for dinner. If you want to talk about those things, I will continue to listen, right? And the fact is, whoa. Could you imagine right now if all of us were drinking at this very moment? We'd have this thing torn down to rafters in minutes. But then again, imagine on the other hand, if we're all carrying the message of hope. We're all talking about, as a result of the steps, we build a relationship with a higher power. How we got our jobs and our careers, became musicians and artists again. Would that not be more appealing to a new person than me telling my war story? And that's why I don't use my war story. I do very specifically, it says in the big book, when I'm working with a brand newcomer, I better have some drinking stories, right? The fact is I'm alcoholic because I drink too much, but I don't know this, because anybody ever think they're making the choice to drink, right? And if you're here and alcohol is your problem, then detox is as hard as it's ever gonna get for you. But if you suffer from alcoholism, for me, the disease begins where the bottle ends. See, I don't have a problem with alcohol. I get loaded perfectly every time. It works. My problem is that I'm not drinking. I didn't understand that. So, super spiritual, in the treatment center. You know, I'm watching a commercial with two kittens play with a toilet paper roll, and I'm bawling my eyes out. This is the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. And I walked outside, there was a seagull, and it was a sign from God, and you know what, like I said, I'm spiritually charged. And on day 45, I walked out of the 2 p.m. meeting with 105 meetings in 45 days, and I wanted to hang myself. Not one thought of Jesus Christ came in my mind. I realized I was in real trouble at that point there. And I've been going to a lot of meetings, and you know, I did what every good person does when they come into recovery. I did my back taxes. So I'm walking around this treatment center with $5,000 cash and untreated alcoholism. Not a good mix, you know, and I finally got tired of it, and I woke up one morning, I started packing my stuff. And my buddy Jeff said, what are you doing? I said, I can't do this anymore. I hate the way I feel. And he says, tell you what, man, just stay one more night. And I said, okay, I'll stay one more night. And some of the Vancouver's here, and I went to this place called Maritime Group. It's not around anymore, but it was around for a long time. And it was a strong meeting. And so I go to that meeting. I don't know about anyone there new, and if you're in here, I couldn't hear the guys speaking because I'm in here, right? They have the slogans, think, think, think. That's the only one I was doing. And I was thinking about how you're thinking about me, and I'm thinking about how come they're not asking me to share. They're not going to know I'm brilliant that I am, and blah, 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 blah. Right? And I left that meeting, and I started walking back to that treatment center. And this white van pulled up on the side and said, Hope. And it was a mobile mission from the church, the Christian center that was in. This guy would go out and give socks and to the homeless and stuff. And I'd seen him in meetings. I'd seen him around the treatment center. And he pulled over and goes, get in the van. So I get in the van. And he looks at me and he says, are you done? And I lied. I said, yes. He never said another word to me that night. He dropped me off. Next morning, I started packing my clothes again. My roommate started to plead with me. He goes, I swear to God, if nothing happens tonight, I'll even go out with you. And I'm like, right on. I got a running partner because I haven't had that in a long time. And they always say every person has a lower companion. And if you don't, just think about that. Right? So I end up... That night, I ended up at the Native Friendship Center, and it is the most beautiful room in all AA I've ever seen. It's got totem poles and Native art, everyone. It's just spiritual, right? And I leave that meeting. I can't hear anybody because I'm in here again, and I'm walking down the road, and the white van pulls up, says, Hope guy says, get in the van. I get in the van. And he says, tell me what's going on. And I said, well, I'm about 45 days sober. Met some cool people, but I want to drink. And he said something pretty profound. He said, it sounds to me like you don't need any more people. It sounds to me like you need to meet God. And for no better reason than to shut up, I said, okay. And then he did something that's a very classic, which we don't do very much anymore. He said, I'm your sponsor, whether you like it or not. I said, what's your name? He said, it's my name, Arnold, and I'll see you in the classroom upstairs on Monday morning with your big book. And I had a little bit of hope. Somebody had reached out. You know, on that Monday afternoon, seven of us got in this room, and, you know, the guy who was my new sponsor, was taking me through the steps, told his story. And it was nothing like mine. He was an ex-mafia guy. I'm an underground satanic plane guy. But when he started to talk about his internal condition, how he felt the guilt, the shame, the depression, remorse, I was like, how does he know that I feel like that? Right? And I think it was Carla last night said about 10% of the world suffers from the phenomenon of craving. I don't know what the percentage is of people that suffer from a spiritual malady, you know? And the funny thing is there's a lot of 12-step fellowships, Gamblers Anonymous, incest, narcotics, cocaine anonymous, sex anonymous, you know, food anonymous. And the only difference between their steps and our steps is step one, what they're powerless over, and step 12, who they help. Steps 2 to 11 are the exact same in every fellowship, and they're designed to do one thing, connected to a higher power. And I have to reinstate that because I don't know what the message is when I get here. Right? I don't understand the lingo. And you know what? I remember being early in my recovery, and yesterday the guy said, welcome, and I felt embarrassed. And for the next little while, I moved in the back, and we call it the shoe rack. It's where all the slippers, loafers, and runners sit. Or denial aisle. You know, and I remember sitting back there, and I'm about 10 days, and I'm mean mugging everybody. Don't come near me. I'm mad. Right? And a little happy asshole with 30 days comes up. He goes, I'm Jack. And I'm like, buddy, I'm crazy enough. I'll kill the both of us. The good thing it was, though, is there's a lot of old-timers in that meeting, and they'd seen it tons of times before when we come in there, because the disease of alcoholism, like I said, for me, sets in when I'm not drinking. When I'm not drinking is the problem, because drinking for me is the solution. You know, when they call this thing called a phenomenon of craving, once you start, you can't stop. I'll get into a little bit more detail about that. But it's kind of like right here, right now, in this room, every single one of us is in the form of a physical craving, but you don't know it. You're craving air, right? But if I were to sneak up behind you and put a plastic bag over your head, you'd soon realize that you need air, right? And I have to understand this. And so, you know, my sponsor, we went started going through the book, and I tried to read the book on my own, and everybody says, oh, yeah, read the book. And, you know, I'm pretty well read, and I never got to how it works. It says, now we're at step three. Mine was, where did one and two go, right? And it's my opinion only, and seeing as I'm the only one with a microphone, you're all entitled to it. I don't think the book was meant to be interpreted by my mind. I think it was interpreted by somebody who had an experience with the book before. You know, and he started asking questions, and the first question he asked me, which nobody had asked me in the 50 days, He said, Jerry, do you ever drink more than you intend to? I'm like, every single time. Right, I'd tell my wife, I'm going to the bar, have a couple with the boys. I come home 2 days later, one of my stuff's packed on the front porch again. Right? I don't mean to do that. There's no malice in my heart. But at this point, I think I'm just a dirtbag. I don't understand that it's a disease. And just so you know, alcoholism is the only disease that says you don't have a disease. Right? People with cancer don't try to convince themselves they don't have cancer. Like, what do you think? I'm an idiot? Of course I don't have cancer. You know? And so having this guy finally describe the questions, the three questions that were never asked to me in the 50 days there. And the second one, he said, have you ever had a really good reason not to drink and found yourself drunk? And I said, all the time. Birthdays, Christmases, wedding anniversaries, court, right? And this is the part of drinking. And I hear a lot of people, and you know, one says, oh, I knew I was alcoholic because I was a blackout drinker. And I'm like, well, lots of people blackout. Normal people blackout too. Anybody ever blackout and come to in a strange place? Like being arrested? It's like, I just got here. Can you tell me what's going on? I don't know what's going on right now. You know? But again, that doesn't make me an alcoholic. And I'm going to say this for my friend Mike. I'm not an alcoholic because my parents put the swing set too close to my house, right? I'm alcoholic because I have a predisposition in my body that I produce alcohol differently than normal people do. And you know what? There's a big scientific reason behind it, and I tried to figure it all one day, and then I read Dr. Bob's last message, and let's then louse this up with Freudian things or things that are interesting in the scientific mind that have very little to do with our work, right? And I use this with my guys where I work. I'll say, you know what? If I'm stabbing you in the gut, are you asking why is he stabbing me or how do I make him stop? Who cares why? Just make him stop. And it's the same thing with alcoholism. I don't know why I have alcoholism. It doesn't matter. I have it. What can I do about it? And that's the important part. That's the integrity message of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you're not sure what the message is, it's right there. It says, having had a spiritual awakening result of these steps, we try to carry this message to alcoholics and practice these principles in all our affairs. And that is, in a nutshell, the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, right? So now I've understood the physical phenomenon of craving. Anybody had that? Once you start, you can't stop, right? And then I have this idea. I have this idea that it's going to be different the next time, right? That's my idea is, you know, the train light at the end of the tunnel ain't going to happen this time. And you know what? And I like to drink for a party. And, you know, I remember standing in the liquor store with my Jack Daniels, my case of beer, and I'm happy. I'm like, this is going to be a great night, right? Pamela Anderson's going to show up with a beer truck, right? AC/DC's going to be playing live, right? Everybody's going to be beautiful. And this is what I got going in my mind. And I come to and I'm, you know, behind Carnegie Hall with one shoe playing hide and tweak. And I don't understand what happened. Right? Because, again, I don't know the symptoms of alcoholism at this point. I think I'm making that choice. Right? And I did not choose to give up my wife, my kids, and my house. And I'm not one of those guys that says, I lost everything. I didn't lose anything. I sold it all unwillingly. Right? Saying I lost things means I'm a victim. And victims get pushed down the stairs. Right? And so that third symptom we talk about, the unmanageability, and my sponsor said, Arnold, he goes, how's your life unmanageable? And I said, well, I lost my house, my wife, my kids, my car. And he goes, right. And he goes, what about those people that haven't lost that stuff? How are they? And I said, I don't know. I guess they're not. And what I found out at that moment there, what we're talking about is an internal condition. This is where the third symptom is. It's called a spiritual malady. Right? And it'll look as a bunch of different things, depression, guilt, shame, and remorse, anxiety, all great reasons to drink. Right? And then they also have that, I think it was mentioned about the hidden mental blank spot. You know, my day can be going perfect. I have not a problem in the world. And next thing you know, I'm sitting in a bar and I don't know how it happened again. I'm down to my last 18 bucks. I showed up here the night before with $1,000 so I could pay my rent, buy groceries, bus pass to get to work. And I come to, it's 11 a.m. in the morning and I got $18 left to my name. And the waitress walks by and says, you want another one, hon? And I want to say no, but I can't. Right? I can't do it. Because alcohol has a grip on me. In Bill's story, he says, alcohol was the master. And I know what it is to be a slave to alcoholism. I'm sure a lot of you people do, right? That bondage between me. And that's the thing, though, like I said. So the spiritual malady they use in doctor's opinion says restless, irritable discontent, right? Unless I can gain the season comfort once they see others taking without impunity. And I remember walking down Gastown and they got, you know, spaghetti factory and there's some, you know, some patio tables out there and I look and there's like, you know, glasses of half a wine or half a beer. I'm like, that would never happen if I was there, right? Like, My wife one time, she pushed a glass of wine across the table. And I said, what? She goes, I said, don't you like it? And she goes, no, I'm feeling it. It's like, me too, right? See, the difference was, though, since she started to drink and drug, she felt like she was losing control. Me, when I start to drink and drug, I feel like I'm coming alive. I get better looking, I'm funnier, I'm smarter, you know, and I realize how blessed you are to have me here, right? And that right there is really the description of a spiritual experience. Everything that alcohol did for me, that gave me that confidence, that happiness, all that stuff, if I don't find something other to do that, then I'll go back to it, right? And what I've learned how to do that is to be present in the moment. And you know what? Like, I've never been here with you before, ever. And I'll never be here in this moment again. So this is sacred to me, right? And I love you. And I say that even to the people that aren't lovable. And that was me when I came, and I wasn't lovable either. So now I understand that I have a threefold disease, body, mind, and spirit. And, you know, I don't know what page it's on. I'm usually pretty good at that stuff. But I think it's in the four steps. It says, for not only have we been mentally and physically ill, the obsession, the allergy, says we've been spiritually sick. Now, the next line in the big book should be in every AA room around the world. And it says, when the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. So I've never worked on the allergy, the obsession. And I didn't work on the spiritual side either. Somebody else did. You know, and show me that way. And I was saying yesterday, I don't know when it was when God infiltrated my life, but all of a sudden I look back and things were pretty good. And I did not know that exact moment then. So, step two, don't like it. And just so you know, every step that's on the wall there, in the big book, they're worded way different, right? And that first one says, we're powerless over alcohol. In the book, it says, I had to concede to my inner self that I'm alcoholic. That's a lot different than admitting something, to concede to my innermost self. You know, and I remember going to that second step, and I didn't want to do the God thing. You know, I told my sponsor, I was like, I don't want to end up like Ned Flanders, right? Like, you know, I don't want to be selling daisies at the airport asking if people have been saved. And I didn't understand the difference between religion and spirituality. And I don't mean to slam anybody or offend anybody, but I'm gonna, and I'll get over it. And, you know, the difference between religion and spirituality, the difference between church and AA is church is about saving souls. A is about saving lives. You know, in that second step, I finally got down and, you know, my sponsor said something very dramatic. He goes, if you don't believe in God, do you believe that I believe in God? And I said, I guess so. And that second step we went through. And step two, and this is, again, only my opinion. I don't think we're ever really on step two. If you're balking at step two, it's because you don't buy in step one that you're an alcoholic with the symptoms. Right in that second step, I asked myself a question. And maybe if you're here and you're new, and you're not feeling it, maybe it's a question you need to ask yourself. And the question was this: what if this works? What happens if I go through the 12 steps and I have an experience with a higher power? What happens if I'm happy, respectful, and useful, and have purpose and dignity and integrity, which I did not have 14 and a half years when I came here? I remember my wife said to me one time, she's like, don't you have any self-respect? But I thought, I lost that years ago, right? Because on the inside, I'm dying. On the outside, I'm looking good. But on the inside, I'm dying. And I'll just let you know, today I have a life that makes sense to me. It may not make sense to you, but my whole life I tried to make it make sense to you, and it made no sense to me. And I'm also one of those guys that says, I don't care what other people think about me. I care. I care a lot. If I claim God in my life, I think I should care, right? So that second step. Third step, get on your knees, say the prayer. God, I offer myself to you. We all know it, right? Voice without a reservation. Took a long time to get to that point there. So when my sponsor took me through the steps, it was like 50 days we went through at the time. So it was a long, drawn-out process. And, you know, step three, again, you're never really on step three. If you're on step three, you're balking at two, or you're on step four. And that's how we finish the third step, is by getting on our knees, saying the prayer, and then write inventory. And you know what? I met a lot of people talk about step four is big, bad, and scary. And I remember in that treatment center, you know, there was, by the time it came around to the four step, there was only two of us left, and there's 38 other clients in the treatment center. And the guy says, what step are you on? I'm like, step four. He's like, ooh. I'm like, I know. And, you know, it was pretty simple. My sponsor came out and says, Jerry, can you go write a list of people, places, and things you hate? And I said, yeah. And he says, go do that. Come see me tomorrow. So I came back with 150 things. Just a little bit angry. Kind of want to set the world on fire by this point in my life. I'm building a doomsday machine. I'm just waiting for a button. And, you know, next column. Tell me what. And If you're new, you haven't done an inventory, again, I'm going to give you a piece of little piece of advice. Give up hope of a better past, right? It's just the past. And when I work with my guys, we're going to do an 8-column inventory. I know a lot of people do it. We're going to do a 5-column personal inventory and a 3-column sex inventory. And you're not going to write a 25-page victim impact statement. That is not what we're about. If you want to do that, rock and roll. Nobody's going to listen, right? And, you know, we got to the 3rd column there. It affects my, you know, self-esteem, security, all that type of stuff. Step 3, I know a lot of people call, or column 4, a lot of people call it my part. And I've never read that in the book anywhere. It says, I look for my own faults and mistakes, right? Because it's saying, if I have a part, then you still play a part, which means you're going to have to change in order for me to get well. And that did not happen, right? And some of the things that can happen along the way are amazing, right? And then the next one was the fear column. And I thought, you know what? As a child, I grew up on a Native reserve, and I was brutally picked on. Like kids tie me to a tree and throwing rocks at me and stuff. And, you know, one time I got mad and, you know, I hit this guy and it didn't do any effect on him, but he beat the crap out of me. And he didn't know, though, that violence masked my fear. And I became a violent criminal. I've done a number of years in prison for violence. And I can tell you, I don't have a violent bone in my body today. I'm not capable of doing those things. God changed my heart at a molecular level. Right, and so we get through the fear column, and you know, I had a lot of fears, maybe 50 or 60 altogether, and I've said this every place I've ever been. My biggest fear today is finding a book by Bill Wilson called Just Kidding. I'll just terrify the shit out of me. My God, it's hot up here. I'm alcoholic, better make it a double. Sex inventory, felt dirty. Realized I was a scumbag. Worked with a lot of women, same thing, right? And that's part of the deal is, you know what, sometimes I would take a lot of heat in my early recovery because I work with women through the 12 steps. And I think in the old preamble says we're a fellowship of men and women who share experience, strength, and horror in order to get sober together. So if there was no, you know, males taking women through the book, there would, you know, Bill Wilson and them, they wouldn't have been anywhere. So, and I don't care who I work with. I don't care if you're white or black. I don't care if you're gay or straight. I don't even care if you're red or blue. Actually, I do care if you're blue. You probably need air. But I work with alcoholics. And I'm going to explain this a little bit. In that step 3 there, I was, it says some of us suffer from mental disorders. And I used to make fun of that when I got sober. And I'll explain why I respect it now. So in that, I would tell people in meetings that I had paranoia with low self-esteem. So I thought nobody important was out to get me. Right? And I hate being bipolar. It's awesome. Getting ready to do a 5. Most terrifying thing I've ever thought about in my entire life. I've got some secrets. I'm not going to tell them. Nobody's ever going to know these. I'm going to bury them deep, deep, deep. And I'm at the back gate. My sponsor set me up with a stranger to do a fist step with. He was another alcoholic. And I remember I'm at the back gate there, and I got my 4-step, and it was on pink paper back then. And what had happened is I went to a Staples bookstore and said, yeah, we're a nonprofit society. We need paper. We don't even have any donations. They gave me 2 cases of pink paper. And so for about the first year and a half in Vancouver, when you went into a meeting, they seen the pink paper. They're like, oh, you're doing the steps with Jerry. And eventually, you know what, like, that fist step was insane, and I kept feeling like I had to take a pee, and this guy was late, and I was like, yes, I'm not going to have to do this, and, you know, he shows up, and he opens the door, and a big cloud of smoke comes out, and I'm like, this guy's baked, right? You can just see this guy's stoned, and turns out he wasn't stoned, that was serenity. I'd just never seen it like that before. You know, and he picked me up in his Jeep, and we started driving down Hastings, and he hung a right on Victoria, and we're driving up the road, and I'm like, this is kind of strange. And he pulls over on the side of the road, and he says, I found a place just up the road here. I'm like, this is, like, really strange now. And we walk up to this park, and he says, I thought we could do it here. And I said, did somebody tell you to come here? And he said, no, why? I said, I can't do this here. He said, why not? I said, this is where I come after work and drink. This place is. And he said the most profound thing I'd ever heard. He said, no better place to meet God than we used to run with the devil. You know? And we went into this fist step, and you know, got on my knees and said the 3rd step prayer. And like I said, I got a couple secrets I'm not going to tell. And he tells me a little about his story, and his big one is the same as mine, but I'm still not going to say it. And we sit down, he goes, let's have the big one right now. And I went, bleh. And I puked out the worst thing. He goes, let's have the other one. And I'm like, this guy knows everything. You know, and about an hour and 45, hour, 50 minutes in this park doing a fifth step with this guy. And we're done and we start walking back to his Jeep. And I'm like, this guy must just think I'm a scumbag, a dirtbag for all this stuff that I've done. And he looked over and he winked. He goes, way to go, you just did it. And without a word of a lie, things became acute. I always knew a tree was green. But in that moment, I realized there was about 800 shades of green. All my senses became heightened. I felt lighter, right? I felt peace on the inside. And there are some important instructions after you do a 5-year, go spend an hour in meditation. And all I can do is describe to you what happened to me is I went into my room and I fell on my knees and I started to weep. I don't know if you know what that is. Those are called tears of joy. Right, and I had this sensation that love exploded in my heart. And it felt like somebody was pouring warm water over me, flowed through my entire body. And something physically came down, put its arms around me, said, it's going to be okay. And I came out of that fifth step. My sponsor was there. He says, what's going on, Jerry? And I said, I don't think I'm ever going to drink again. And he said, perhaps the most important thing I ever heard. He said, I know, I believe you. You just had a spiritual experience. And if you want, I can show you how to have another one. I was like, yes, I want to feel this for the rest of my life. And that's what steps 6 through 12 are about, how to reproduce this feeling, not in me, but in you. And when you get sober, I get to stay sober. The fact is I love taking people through the steps, but even more, I love watching others take people through the steps, like the guys I sponsor. And guys are always like, oh, I don't know if I can do it. I'm like, you know what the coolest part is? They don't know that you don't know what you're doing, right? If you can read and share your experience, not only can you, I think you're obligated to, you know, and I sponsor a number of people. Most of the people I sponsor are between 5 and 10 years who run stagnant in their own recovery, or they have mental health issues, and I'll explain that a little bit. But, you know, I think sometimes we tell newcomers stupid things like find a sponsor, or, like that's their responsibility. Our responsibility is find you. And I asked one time, I said, how do you find a sponsor? And a guy said to me, he goes, find somebody that's got what you like. I would like to drink. Right? What I needed a sponsor who'd suffered from alcoholism and recovered to the 12 steps and was willing to share that message with me. You know, and like I said, in that hour afterwards, I was so lit up, I did not want to go to sleep because I was afraid the feeling would go away. It was like 5 a.m. the next morning, my alarm goes up at 6 a.m., and I still felt it. And just so you know, 14 and a half years later, I feel it right now. And you know what, I love the way you participate in this. And you know, this is a while back, I was doing the talk and you're laughing and hallelujah and stuff. And I felt this connection I'd never felt before with you people. And it was so intense on the end here. The thought that came to my mind was, I wonder if this is how God feels about us. Because if it is, I want more. And here's the deal, if God were the ocean, would you show up with a thimble? Or would you go skinny dipping? You get to choose how much of God you want to know, and it'll be by your effort that you put into it. Step 6 and 7, in a nutshell, motives, right? I steal money from work, and my defective character is greed. You know, like, I'm not going to get a whole lot into it. There's a bunch of good books, but in 6 and 7, it's only 2 paragraphs in the big book, right? And so some of the things I'll just describe. I'm at my home group. A guy puts up his hand as a newcomer. A song plays in my mind right away. Dun, dun, dun. Dun, 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 dun. And I get him outside and somebody else has got him and he's feeding him, you know, don't worry, stay until the miracle happens and, you know, but for the grace of God, I'm like, he's going to kill this guy. Now, I can go over and say one thing with 3 different motives, right? I can go over and make him look bad, me look good, or help him. And at that point in time, I had to do nothing because my defect was to make him look bad, even though it wouldn't have changed a word of what I said. It would be the exact same, but the motive's gone. And that's where 6 and 7 come into play. And so I think in the 11th step, it actually says, you know, we ask God to be divorced from selfish, self-seeking motives. I think it's meant, let's do step 7, then go to step 11 afterwards, right? Because that's what it asked me to divorce myself from. And so in that 6 and 7, in the 12 and 12, it says, here are the steps we balked at. And, you know, I watch a lot of baseball, and they thing have it called balk there. And what it is the pitcher makes like he's going to do one thing, but he actually does something else. And, you know, it's like, if God really takes away my lust, will that mean I'll lose the drive to make money? Like, do I lust for money? And it says in there, it says, God will take them good and bad. I guess apparently some of my defects are quite delightful, right? Steps 8 and 9, couldn't do it. Step 8 was made when I did the step 4 list. It says we list the people we've hurt. Step 8 is about becoming willing. Step 9 is about making them. I made my final amends May 11th, 2023. I had 85 original amends on my 4-step, and I did about another 20 on that. And my final amends, I'd actually done all my amends except 2 at 11 years. And then I had to wait another 3 years to do the other ones. And that was to my ex-wife for the money I owed her and personally to her. And just so you know, it took me 8.5 years to pay off $52,000 in back child support. And when I phoned her that morning when I made the last payment to her, and I said, you know, I'm gonna, and she goes, Jerry, just stop. She goes, I forgave you a long time ago, but I didn't have the courage to ask her, because what happens, I stop making the payments or something happens, I wanna be sure that was done. And so, you know, for 8 years, I was a single dad. My second daughter, Brittany, I was with another woman, and I went to the hospital and I took Brittany home at 3 days sober, and her mom didn't come see her until she was 40 days sober, or 3 days alive. I brought her home and her mom didn't come visit her till 40 days later. And again, I made that promise to that child, right? And at 8 years, she was 8 years old, my alcoholism was starting to run rampant. Like, I was at the point where, you know, I'm borrowing money, I'm stealing stuff from work, and I can't stop it. And I got to the point where I said, I have to give my daughter up. And I gave her to her mom. And within a month, she was in the ministry, and my aunt and uncle took her in for a couple of years, and my ex-wife with my other 2 children took her in for a long time. And you know what I'd found out? She had ended up in foster care. And I wrote a letter to the ministry stating who I was, that I was Brittany's dad, and you know, I just want to make sure she's okay, and if she ever wants to contact me, I left my phone number. And nothing's happening, and about 6 months go by, and I'm in this restaurant, Trocadero's Greek restaurant, where we go for a meeting, we go for a Souvlaki and lamb, and like really good stuff afterwards, and my phone rings, and I don't recognize the number, and I pick it up, and I go, hello, dad? And it's my daughter. She's 17, almost 17 years old at this time, and I said, can I come see you? And she says, I'm off work this week, and I said, I'll be over on the first ferry. And I remember I'm standing outside of the Eaton Center, and I'm waiting for her. I can see her coming. She's probably about 5 miles away, it feels, and she's walking towards me. I start to get welled up, and I'm starting to get really emotional. And that last 10 feet she was there, I just ran up, and I grabbed her, and I hugged her, and I'm bawling my eyes out. I mean, like snot bubble crying, right? And she says, I know, Dad, we'll fix it. It'll be okay, it'll be okay. And you know, when I got to make amends to her, you know, I regret the fact that a relationship was harmed because I didn't use alcoholism or drug addiction as an excuse at all. That is not an excuse for me to make amends because I'm a drunk, right? And I remember we went across the street to Earl's, and we're having some lunch, and my brother came with me. I hadn't seen her in about 5 years. And she goes, I got something. She slid a piece of paper across the table. I said, what's that? She said, that's Shantaya's phone number. She wants you to call her. It's my oldest daughter. And so I call her, and we're talking, and she says, I got a surprise. I said, what's that? And I hear, hello, and it's my youngest daughter, Justice, on the phone. And I said, is there any way I can see you? And she said, yeah, Mom will drive us in tomorrow if you want to stay another day. I said, absolutely. And I got to make amends to those kids, right? I asked them how to make it right, and one of the things was just be there. The other one was stay sober, and the most important one that I got, we just want you to be happy. And that's exactly what happened with my brother, too. When I went to make amends to him, I hadn't seen him in 19 months, and I owed him some money. And we met, and I said, here's your money. And he said exactly what I wanted to hear. You know what he said? Don't worry about the money. And I said, you know what? It's your money. You do what you want. He says, I'll make you a deal. And he said, what's that? He goes, for the next 3 months, you come by every other week, and you vacuum the hallways and the stairways of this apartment building. And then he matched. I said, absolutely. And then I asked him, I said, is there anything else? He said, Jerry, I just want to see you happy. So for the last 14 and a half years, every time I go to my brother's, I'm happy. Right? And the real trick to making amends, and this is, again, the way I do it. It may not be the way you're doing it. But I don't tell them what I'm going to do. I ask them, what do I need to do to make this right between the two of us? That's a lot different than telling them what we're going to do. And here it is. If you go with tact and common sense, like the book says, most people aren't going to say ridiculous things. Right? The punishment will fit the crime that I created. And like I said yesterday, though, if I'd known I was going to have to make all this shit right later in life, I wouldn't have done it in the first place. Right? But, you know, lack of power is our dilemma, it says. And mine's a little bit different today. Lack of dilemma is my power today. I don't have to be dramatic. In that 8th and 9th step, the heart and soul. And I know I hear people talk about 10, 11, and 12 as being the maintenance steps. And I've never said that. And actually, after the promises, our next function was to grow in understanding and effectiveness, not to maintain. What am I growing? Relationship with God, right? Make sense? Growing my relationship, understanding the big book, the literature better, so I'm more effective at helping others. You know, and guys are like, oh, we can't do it like you. Well, you don't need to. I'm already doing it that way. We need you doing it the way you do it to get to this place of love in the heart, right? And it's kind of like, you know, say you two here want to get from here to the marina, and you jump in your taxi and you say, I want the direct route, the quickest way there. And you say, well, I want to go through part of Iron Bound. And the cab driver says, well, it's going to cost more. It's going to take longer. You say, no, right? But I love the scenery better. The destination is still the same place. And so however you get to God in your own journey, we should all end up at the same place. And the one thing I know for sure, if God only had one quality that all of us could agree on, what would that be? Exactly love. Exactly love. Pure love. Kind I've never felt before. So that 10th step doesn't mean at the end of the day I take inventory and go, right? It means on the spot I make the amends. Right? And I remember being in this treatment center, and the first place they stick you is in the dish pit, and you feed 500 homeless people in about 2 hours, and we're in the dish pit, and I got this, and I'm not being religious, but a French guy, and he talked like this, right, all the time, and finally he looked over and said, if you can't talk and work in the same time, shut up. And then after the thing, I was like, oh man, I shouldn't have said that. And I pulled him off the side. I said, listen, I really regret the fact. I didn't need to be treated like that. I'm like, did I leave anything? I was going, well, you. And he started, and I was like, yeah, well, you. And making amends is hard, but making round two with the same amends, it's even harder. So the 10th step I watched throughout my day. And I think watch is the spiritual principle. It says watch for resentment, fear. But I think you just watch new people come in and you watch them change. It's the reason I'm here. And you know what? My sponsor today says, you know what? Like, a candle loses nothing by lighting another candle, right? And that's all we are. That step 10 keeps me in the moment. Step 11, did not practice prayer and meditation for about my first 6 months. The guy when here was talking about Newton Bill. Who was that? He gave me that same advice. He says, when you want to pray in the morning, go in the bathroom, lock the door, open the window, and yell, help! And at the end of the day, go in your bathroom, lock the door, open the window, go, thank you. And that was about to the extent of my prayer and meditation life. And I was about 6 months sober. And one morning, my sponsor phoned me. He said, what's going on, Jerry? And I said, how are you doing? I said, I'm doing really good. He goes, why is that? And I had him. I said, because of God. He goes, right. He goes, what about that girlfriend? Where did she come from? I said, from God. He goes, what about that job where you make all that money? Where'd that come from? I said, from God. He said, how much time are you spending on this morning, Jerry? I said, screw you, Arnold. You know, and let's see what I'm running here. I went to a meeting at the 11 o'clock that night, and there was a lady talking about prayer and meditation, and she made it sound so amazing. And it's funny, because I have a buddy back in Vancouver. He talks about how he was working with one guy that got to step 11, and the guy goes, I don't want to meditate. He says, what do you mean you want to meditate? It's the easiest thing you can do next to doing nothing. And so I go home, I turn off the TV, I light a couple candles, I sit on the edge of my bed, I take a deep breath, then this happens. What are you going to think about? 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 And when it got quiet out there, it got noisy in here, but I sat there for 2 minutes anyway. And at night I sat there for 2 minutes, and the guys I work with, anybody know how many minutes there are in a 24-hour period? 1,440. So if you just take 2 minutes in the morning, 2 minutes at night, that will give you 1,436 minutes to do whatever else you want with, right? And I would race in there, but I would just spend that time. And I remember after I had a good meditation one time, I walked outside my place and there was a squirrel, and it was like, nice to see you outside my head for the first time ever. Because I've learned to get quiet on the inside, right? And that was a hard one for me. And that fifth step, there's a promise that says we can be alone at perfect peace and ease. And that is by far my favorite promise in the entire book. My whole life had the window open, the radio on, the TV on because of the background noise. And I realized, you know, when I first got sober, I told you I was a spiritual giant. I thought God had this thundering voice inside my head. Me and him were like this. And, you know, after a while, I realized that was my ego thinking what God was going to say through me, for me. And I realized it wasn't. When I actually finally learned to properly meditate, I realized that God was not loud. It was not boastful. He was quiet and calm and gentle. And the only time I could hear him was when I was silent. And that's the main thing about medication. Medication. Wow. You don't have time for prayer and meditation. You have time for complaint and medication, that's for sure. And I started to, you know, move along, and I was getting into, you know, I was doing mantras, I was doing visual, I was doing guided visual, I was doing frequencies and waves crashing. And, you know, the one that worked for a long time was mantras. And because I could keep my mind on that. And so what I'd do is I'd open the big book and I'd see something that says, "Thy will not mine be done." And I say, I just try to get to count to five with just that on my mind. It'd be like, one, "Thy will not mine is done." Two, "Thy will not mine be done." Three, "Thy will not mine be done." Four, "That woman at Starbucks had big tits." I mean, please tell me that didn't come out loud. Because I was thinking it. Don't say it, Jerry. Don't say it. Don't say it. It's the filter. It's broken. Can't replace it with a Brita either. Heart and soul, this program, prayer and meditation, life for me. I cannot do what I do. If anybody were to ever ask me, the most important fact of my life, not my sobriety, is my relationship with God. Right? And whatever you want to call it is your business. Call it Mr. Magoo for all I care. But you better find something. Anybody in here, you know why we pray and meditate? Anybody? Because it works, right? Anybody ever go out without prayer and meditation? They start to go sideways? That's the exact way I am too. So my meditation since I've been here is like amazing. My hotel room overlooks the ocean and the palm trees and stuff. And I get up out there and I grab my cup of coffee and I just sit out there and I get close to God. And it's not that I don't believe God's with me, but I believe God's a gentleman. And he doesn't go where he isn't invited, and he doesn't stay where he isn't welcomed. So I have to welcome and invite him in my room. And, you know, a lot of people talk about one day at a time. And this morning I woke up, I did not surrender. Because in order for me to surrender means there has to be a fight. And I have to be losing that fight because nobody surrenders while they're winning. Right? So what happened this morning is I got up and I volunteered to be one of God's guys. And he takes care of the sobriety for me. I don't magically do things to keep myself sober. Right, and that's the only way I can have conscious contact God is when I'm present in the moment. Right, that's the only time. If I'm doing this or climbing a clear way wreckage of the future that doesn't exist, I miss the point. Right, and like I said, if you're here and you're new and you're hearing this stuff, please, this is so much more than just about not drinking one day at a time. Right, it says we have a fulfilled life. Page 20, my very life depends upon the constant thought of others and how I may help meet their needs. Right? And that 11th step gives me the power to do the impossible, and that's care about you. Right? And I love you people. In that 12th step, we get to do a lot of stuff. I'm not trying to brag or anything, but in the last 14 years, I've taken thousands through the steps. That's where I go. I've had other positions. I've been a GSR. I've been, you know, a secretary and all that. And that stuff was really cool. But where I found my niche was, you know, in 12-step working In about 2 weeks, I'll have worked at the same job for 8 years as I work in a treatment center, a men's treatment center. And it's like fishing with dynamite there, right? You don't got to look very far. But the other thing is, you know what? You'll find a lot of people that don't want to do steps. You'll find them in treatment centers and meetings, right? A lot of people come here and don't want to do this. Why do I feel good, right? Because maybe they don't have the same symptoms as I do. And that's the deal, right? Like, because you're in Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't mean you're an alcoholic. You might be. You may be a hard drinker. But it's kind of like, you know, the third trend says we have a desire to stop drinking. Well, I have a desire to be a chicken, right? And I can walk around and scratch and peck and bawk, bawk, but without symptoms like feathers, a beak, and the ability to lay eggs, I'm never going to be a chicken. And so we have a description of alcoholism in our book, not a definition, right? And that's about what that is, trying to relay the message to you about how I drank, how I overdrank, how I underdrank, but the bottom line was it was about alcohol, and I thought just stopping would solve my problem, and I realized it wasn't. And I found the greatest joy in my life is working with new people. I get to do these talks and some workshops and stuff, but when you're sitting across a guy reading a book and you see the lights come on, you'll want to do it again, right? And they say, if you don't like the experience here, we'll refund your misery on the way out. So, step 12, and I know, you know, there's a lot of opinions around step 12. I'm not so sure I agree with any of them, but, you know, it says we try to carry this message, and sometimes people think stacking chairs and stuff is 12-step work. And I don't know if it is or not, but I know what you're doing there is allowing people like us to do 12-step work. Like, it's got to be done. Like, I found there's three types of people in AA. There's seed planters, there's waterers, and there's harvesters, right? Your job, maybe tonight, you meet a new guy, plant the seed, right? Somebody else takes in some meetings, waters him, and then you come down here, and you get to take him through the 12 steps and harvest. Not one job is more important than the rest, but we need to do them all, right? And you know what? We take care of our drunks. And in that 12-step, I work with a drunk. We're going to do this thing in a couple of days, week, 2 weeks, the most. And I don't care if you remember anything we said, because the information you'll gain when you start to work with others, right? And how it works, it says, here are the steps we took. Not the steps I analyzed, memorized, overlooked. By taking the actions, things started to happen. Second set of steps, take all the time in the world you want. Get a dictionary, a thesaurus, write out whatever you want. But I think the real crucial one is in step. And how it works, it says, may you find God now. Not three relapses, not 6 months from now, but now. And they use words like rocketed, suddenly, catapulted, immediately, all those type of things. And to me, it's the indication we're to work very quickly through this deal. Because if we don't get these new people in that are hurting, if we don't give them a solution, they're going to disappear again. And it's one of the hardest things to watch is people leave. You know, but what happens is we leave this fellowship one judgment at a time. And I was the same way. We became super judgmental and resentful. I wanted to get out of the deal. Right? So I'm just going to end with a couple stories here. I introduced myself as Jerry Wills. And my last name, I'm the last male of my lineage. And it's kind of a sad thing about it. And 6 years ago, my daughter phoned me. And she said, Dad, I'm pregnant. We want to name the baby after you. And I don't know if you can get anything better than that in the entire world than somebody to carry on a legacy. I also have, so his name is Micah Jerry Wilson. I have Robert Jerry Wilson. I have Juliet Romaine Wilson. My name gets to live on. And the very first time Micah was born, my girlfriend Jane, I don't know where she is. She's in here somewhere. We drove out to the ferry terminal to pick up my daughter and my grandson, who I'd never met before. And we get up there, and she's in his little car seat, and she says, I got to wake him up or he's going to stay awake. I said, well, let's just get back to the house. We'll get him set up. And, you know, we get up there, and we set up his little playpen and stuff. And she goes over, and she undoes his little belt buckle and rubs his belly and goes, Micah. And he does this little adorable stretch and yawn, right? And she woke him up. She woke him up. Now, it's no different. What she did next was the most important part, is she picked him up and walked with him. And that's what you've done in Alcoholics Anonymous with me. You woke me up, and you've walked with me. And because you've walked with me, I'll walk with you. Last thing, and I remember I was joking about the mental illness thing. I don't mean to be funny, but my experience was there's bottoms in AA. And I came in here, and I had two of the four. I had the physical and the financial bottom. At 3 years sober, I've entered into the emotional and spiritual bottom. What had happened was at 3 years sober, I was doing some inventory work, and I looked down, I'd written a suicide note, and I don't remember writing it. And I started having visions of hanging myself from my treehouse in my backyard. And I'd been awake for a couple of days, I couldn't shake the thoughts. And my roommate boss at the same time said, let's get you to the hospital, get you checked out. And so I went there, and they were gonna keep me for a weekend observation, like someone would say, and I'm spending 17 weeks there. And I stayed awake for 13 days. With nothing. The nurses said, we can give you something to help you sleep. I said, you give me something, I kick down your door, I'm going to take it all. And on that 13th morning when I woke up, there were two nurses at my door and they were clapping because I'd slept. They could see the pain and anguish. And one of the ladies there, nurses, said, this is the most amazing thing I ever seen. And I said, what's that? She goes, every single day you've been here, you've had no less than 5 visitors every single day. And it just goes to prove you can pretend to care all you want, but you can't pretend to show up. And you showed up for me, and I'll show up for you. In that hospital there, and I truly believe there is no human power to relieve my alcoholism, but there's been times along the way where I've been lost. And it was you people, the fellowship, the humans that carried me back to the message of God when I lost my way. So I want to thank you for that. And when I got in that hospital there, I never stopped believing in God, but I thought God stopped believing in me. You know, and I got on my knees and I said an honest prayer that morning. I said, God, I'll do anything to get to know you better. And he spoke to me. He said, if you want to get to know me, get to know my children. And that's you people, the fellowship. And the more I meet, work with, and come to help, the better I know God. So if I've not met you, please come shake my hand. I need to know God better. God bless you all.